Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Suzanne Griffiths in honor of her daughter, Christine Cleeton, on her birthday.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at will.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. On the program today, we'll hear about American women in the Catholic Church who are pushing for progressive reforms. The women we'll hear about are calling the church to openness and accountability. They are questioning the church's stand on celibacy and contraception. They are defending victims of clergy sex abuse. They are advocating the ordination of women. And here's something that's quite interesting. They are changing the face of the ministry. Women today represent more than 80% of lay paid parish ministers and 70% of chaplains serving in hospitals, hospices, colleges, and prisons. Our guest this afternoon is journalist Angela Bonavolia. She is the author of Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church. The book is also in part a memoir of her return to the church. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Angela Bonavolia. Her work has appeared in several publications, including the Chicago Tribune, The Nation, and Newsday. Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church is published by Regan Books, an imprint of HarperCollins. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Angela, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
It's great to be here, Celeste.
What led you away from then back to the church?
Well, it was a long path, I think. I grew up Catholic, deeply devoted to my church. I just loved it. I spent, as I say in the book, I spent a lot of time in the basement chapel of my church talking to God, and God listened. And I just took those moments of really peace and trust with me all my life. For me, the first breakaway was really when I became a teenager and began to become sexually active. I just found the church's judgment of me as a girl struggling with her sexuality was really very harsh. And I had a confessor who was very harsh in terms of how I was treated. And then I noticed that, you know, women, I knew that, you know, that women couldn't be near the altar. We couldn't touch things sacred. So I really kind of became aware of my place in the Catholic Church, and I found that very wounding as a young woman, and I began to pull away. And then in my early 20s, I moved to New York from Scranton, Pennsylvania, where I grew up. And I came back home to visit my mom in Scranton one weekend, and I just had this tremendous longing to go back to church. So I did. I went to the rectory at St. Anne's Monastery, which was my church, and I wanted my confession heard. And I was ushered into the confessional, and the priest Basically, he had been drinking. It was 7 o'clock in the morning. He asked me to come into his study to finish my confession. I was able to get out of there, but it was a very uncomfortable and difficult experience. But for me, I went in there feeling like my only way to God was through the priests who were God. And somehow I left there feeling that I had a more direct connection to God and to the church, and having a different way of looking at the priests who I had grown up with. So then I became kind of a Catholic wanting change in the church, and I started writing about women's reproductive health, and I was on the board of an organization called Catholics for Free Choice for a time. And I really felt hopeful. But then I have to say, my hope, you know, sort of as Pope John Paul II's papacy moved on, and he became more and more closed to women's full participation in the church, I lost hope again. And then basically what happened was in the year 2001, I learned about a woman named Joan Chittister, who was a nun, who found the courage to say no to the Vatican. I learned more about her, and I'd be happy to talk about that if you want me to.
Yeah, I do want you to talk about that. I want you to talk about Sister Joan and Sister Christine Vladimirov.
Amazing, amazing women.
They said no to the Vatican.
They
and
did.
Vladimirov stood by Sister Joan Chittister's decision to speak out about the ordination of women.
Absolutely. What happened was Sister Joan, who I didn't know anything about at the time, she's an orator, she's a prolific writer, she's a really a brilliant woman. She does a lot of writing now on peace and justice and has all of her life and is very deeply devoted to equality for women in the church. Well, she was invited to speak at the first World Conference on Women's Ordination, which was to be held in Dublin, Ireland. And when the Vatican found out that she had been invited to speak, they sent a letter to her community, which were the Erie Benedictines in Erie, Pennsylvania, and basically said she could not go. She was to be silenced. And this was deeply upsetting to her, and she had to think about it, but not very long, because she felt, she said to me, how can I tell other women who are abused to get out of those situations if I allowed myself to be abused in that way? And she really felt that the issue wasn't even ordination, it was silencing, that silencing can never be good for the church. So she thought she would be going to this conference by herself, and actually told me she thought she would become just another scapegoat, and that would be kind of the end of her life as it was. But as it turned out, and as you say, the prioress of the monastery, Christine Vladimirov, who was supposed to issue the silencing order, she was supposed to do the kind of the Vatican's dirty work there, she did her own discerning about what to do, and she actually flew to Rome to talk to the people there about what obedience meant in the Benedictine order, which wasn't just laying down the law, it was a process of helping the person to come to their own decision. Anyway, Sister Joan, until the night before she was going to Ireland, thought she was going to be going by herself and taking this risk by herself. But they had a meeting in the chapel at the Benedictine Monastery, absolutely gorgeous chapel with these stained glass windows. It's just a beautiful place. And Sister Christine stood up and said that she could, to all of the members of this community, that she could not issue the Vatican order, and that she wasn't going to do that. And then she said to the people sitting in that audience, if any of you feel comfortable signing this letter, and she had a letter in her hand, joining me in this, that would be wonderful. And then Sister Christine went to her seat, and she didn't realize it, but up the aisle were coming all of these women, many of them elderly, many of them on, you know, walkers and canes, to the same altar where they had taken their vows as nuns, and they signed onto this letter. 126 of them signed on to the letter to the Vatican saying, we support Sister Joan going and speaking. And not only that, there were 22 other Benedictine communities around the United States, and they all signed on. So it was, I thought that was something different. To me, that it was such a stand for honesty, for speaking out, for dialogue in our church. And to have all of those strong women standing like that, I know as I began to speak to people afterwards that it had an impact on Catholics who want change in the church.
Did these women put themselves at risk of excommunication?
Oh, absolutely. And in that case, I mean, they could have. There are all sorts of things. They could have forced Joan out of the order. They could have taken Sister Christine Vladimirov out of her position as prioress, which she was very afraid of because she felt very protective of all the women there. They could have lost a lot, and excommunication certainly as well. But because they stood together, the Vatican backed down.
Yeah.
And nothing was ever done. Although, when I went to stay with them for a weekend, when I just absolutely fell in love with them once I went to meet them, they still, you know, sort of had this thing hanging over them in terms of would there ever be any action taken. And fortunately, there never was. But yes, you're right. There are, all of the women and good Catholic girls who took stands like that have taken enormous risks, and some of them have lost a lot in the process of doing what they've done.
Yeah. Well, it's really quite interesting how you write about Vladimirov and how she turned to prayer, and she really gave this a lot of consideration and thought, and she was terrified.
She was terrified.
She was scared to death, she told you. She was scared on two counts. You know, she was scared that that what would become of the community. And she, you write, if she refused to issue the precept and Rome removed her as prioress, she would be no longer be able to protect them. I'm 62, she said. I've been here since I was 17. It's my whole life.
Yes, yes. The enormous risks they took.
But she's also very concerned about the credibility. Is that the right word to use? Let me see if I can call up this passage here. She said, there is a fundamental difference in the understanding of obedience in the monastic tradition and that which is being used by the Vatican to exert power and promote a false sense of unity inspired by fear.
Yes, yes. That's exactly right. And she's, I mean, they're Benedictines, and they have, there's a long history in, you know, the rule of Benedict in terms of dialogue. It's not at all a rule of, you know, just laying down the law and saying you have to do this and that. It's dialogue. It's trying to help someone come to their what their conscience tells them to do, trying to help them come to what works for them. And she was held to that principle. She held herself to that principle, despite the fact that she was taking an enormous risk. And for her as well as for Sister Joan, both of them, it was silencing that they were really reacting to. And silencing during the time of John Paul II was, you know, used as a tool very often, and it continues, unfortunately, under our new pope. America Magazine, a wonderful Jesuit magazine that has really had a history of giving both sides of a lot of the difficult issues in our church, was headed by a wonderful priest, Tom Rees, for many years, and he was actually removed from that position because of the kinds of issues the magazine took on, and this happened just a few months ago. And the alternative to removing him was that the Vatican was going to insist that there be a committee of censors to review everything that came into the magazine. So this silencing has been used, and to stand up against it was a really important thing. And I found it really very interesting that this act by the Benedictines took place in 2001, before the sex abuse scandals broke all over our country, beginning in Boston in 2002. But when that happened, this image of what these women did influenced Catholics who took a stand and who began to call the church to accountability around the sex abuse crisis. I interviewed a wonderful priest named Walter Kunin, who's up in the Boston area, who helped to establish a new organization called Priest Forum at the time, and it was intended to give priests an opportunity to really sit down and talk about the issues they were grappling with, from birth control to celibacy, all of that. And he said that one of his influences was the Erie Benedictines. He said, you're always afraid that if you stand up, something horrible will happen. But if everybody stands up, it's much less likely that that's going to happen. And he ended up leading a group that signed a letter that resulted in part, that contributed to the resignation of Boston Cardinal Law, who was implicated in moving many priests around in the Boston area and subjecting children to just horrendous sexual crimes.
Hmm. Well, I suppose we can look at the Erie Benedictines in the power of the 120-plus women who signed on to Sister Christine Vladimirov's letter as in essence, silencing the Vatican, even if it was just for a moment. I'm wondering, though, I mean, is the Vatican listening?
Mm. That's a really good question. You know, it's hard. You can only tell by their reaction. You know, it's not in a positive way. I mean, I came back. I don't know if your listeners know this, if this got any play in your area, but 9 women were ordained priests and deacons on the St. Lawrence Seaway last Monday up in Canada on international waters. They are part of what's called the Danube Women Priests Movement, which began on the Danube River back in 2002. It's one way that Catholic women are moving forward with ordination. Now the church is noticing this. We know that they're noticing this. Syracuse newspaper, for example, did an incredibly huge spread about it. The front page with the women consecrating the Eucharist, the inside page with an interview with a priest and the history of ordination in the church and what the Bible says pro and con, lots of visibility to the issue. So we know that the church is looking at it, but unfortunately, the most we hear in terms of a response is extremely negative. Those 7 women who were ordained on the Danube River in the throes of the sex abuse crisis were all excommunicated 1 month later. Meanwhile, and that was by then Cardinal Ratzinger, our Pope, who was then the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. But in the meanwhile, there was no such drastic action taken against abusive priests or complicit bishops. So we know they're noticing, but unfortunately, what comes back is a very punitive response. But that is not changing the energy and commitment of the women to change, and it's changing on the ground. I mean, as you said before, Catholics are seeing women in ministry now in new ways that they never did before. And even these women who are being ordained, when they go back home, they're getting phone calls from their local parish priest saying, come celebrate a mass with me in someone's home. I know one woman who was ordained on the Danube who's an American woman from Ohio. She was the former First Lady of Ohio. When she got back home after her ordination, a parish priest that she knew asked her to meet with his mother, who was elderly and infirm, in the basement chapel of the church because she had waited her whole life to see a woman priest. So there is just an openness to this that that no matter how negative the leaders of the hierarchy may seem toward it, I think there's a real openness to it on the ground.
Yeah. Well, that was something that I was so struck by, and as you mentioned, I mentioned in my introduction, how much the church relies today on women in its ministry. And, you know, I wonder, does that in and of itself change the church?
I think it absolutely does. I think it absolutely does. It gives people, I think we're hungry for a feminine image of the divine. And I think that it does that. I mean, if we're lying in a hospital bed and we ask to see the Catholic chaplain, and the person who appears in the doorway is not a priest in a Roman collar, but is a lay Catholic woman, that already is an interaction that has deep meaning for us. I mean, I write in Good Catholic Girls in the epilogue, which is a very personal epilogue called Saying Goodbye to Aunt Anne, who was a dear, mm-hmm. dear aunt of mine. And when she died in the hospital, her daughter and husband were there, and as my cousin was closing my aunt's eyes, in the doorway appeared the chaplain, and it was a woman. And that woman came in, that Catholic woman, and said the rosary with them. And it was so meaningful to them. So, you know, they weren't even dealing with ordination, not ordination. Here's this woman representing, bringing the comfort of God and Christ into that room. And that changes things.
Yeah. But in the opening paragraph of that epilogue, you recount a conversation you had previously with your aunt.
Yes.
And she said, Angela, plenty of Catholic women like things the way they are, and besides, nothing is going to change until there is another pope, period. So what about that? What of the women who like things the way they are?
That is such a hard question. I guess, you know, I have one answer to that question is, I wish that the Catholic Church would take a page from Judaism. I wish we could stop standing around and saying, well, the real Catholic, please stand up. I wish we had a kind of a reform, a conservative, and an Orthodox wing. Because, in fact, that's what we have. We are all Catholics. We all love the Church. We all have been influenced by the teachings of Christ, by the Church itself. And we disagree on a lot of things. And if we could only have a church where we could have the freedom to disagree, but realize we're all in the same family. So I guess that's the first thing that I would say to that. I wish so much that we could find a way to be together and to talk about these things and to come to some sort of conclusions as time goes by. And the second thing is, I guess in any institution that has wonderful aspects to it but also oppressive aspects to it, change is difficult for people. And I think for a lot of Catholic women who have learned to be very accepting of this very authoritarian church, they hold to the traditional things about it, and they're frightened. They're frightened of losing those things. So, I mean, I think we always have to know that in any institution that's moving toward change, there are always going to be people who are going to be frightened by that and for whom it will be difficult. But to the minds of the women that I interviewed for Good Catholic Girls, that doesn't mean the changes are not important.
Mm-hmm. I get a sense of you as a Catholic being at once progressive and traditionalist.
I am. I am, and it's a very uncomfortable place to be. I mean, I appreciate the traditional parts of this, you know. I mean, it's traditional to just even want to hold on to Catholicism. I mean, there certainly are feminist theologians today who are post-Christian, who are looking at a way different world of spirituality than we have right now. But I think Catholicism gave me so much, I mean, particularly in terms of equality and justice. I mean, I became a social worker. I've worked with foster children and with elderly and infirm people and in hospitals. You know, I took that very seriously, equality, justice, working with the poor, caring about how people live. And I want my church to be out there on those issues. I want my church to be out there on all of those issues. And I got that grounding from my Catholicism, from Christ, from what he said, from the way he lived. And so it's my church, and I don't want to give it up. And I know a lot of Catholic women that I talk to have been on this road. You know, you give it up, but it's very hard to give up Catholicism. As I've said, it gets this hold on you, and it does not let go really easily. You know, there's just these, it's a very hard thing to describe, but that grounding is, it becomes really a part of you. It's very hard to let go of.
One of the questions you set out with when you began work on this book was, why do women stay?
Yes.
How did the women you talked with, who want change, who may be angry with the church, answer that question?
That is the most fascinating question. They answer it in so many different ways. I found some of them have a great sense of humor about it. I mean, I asked one woman who is a fantastic person. She is the spiritual director of Voice of the Faithful, National Voice of the Faithful. So when you go to a Voice of the Faithful meeting, which is a reform group that grew out of the clergy sex abuse crisis, prayers are led by Susan Troy. She is their spiritual director. And she has a Master's of Divinity from a Catholic seminary. So she could be a priest tomorrow. She has the training to be a priest. And she is an incredible person. She's very spiritual and very, just very in life, buoyant and alive. And I asked her, do you think about leaving? She said, every day. I think about leaving every day. But she said, I am not going to leave because by virtue of my training and who I am, I can help Catholic women in the church to have a voice, and I'm not going to leave them voiceless. So that's one way of looking at it. Other women learn to... Another woman I interviewed, same thing, a Master's of Divinity, who is a chaplain in a girls' high school, And she just says, I wish I had spent less time worrying about what I was going to do in this church. She loves the church. She found a way to do her ministry in the church, and she feels like eventually things will work out. Other women are hanging on by their fingernails, you know, they're, especially in terms of a sex abuse crisis. I found women who are just so angry and so upset about what happened and the way it was handled that, you know, one woman said, my anger at the church is only equal by my love for the church. You know, that what do you do with that? So there are a lot of women sort of in that intermediary place. And there are other women who just refuse to leave because it's their church. And, you know, they're just not going to be pushed out. But I have to, you know, I have to add to that this is a really critical moment. If the church continues to move on this very, restrictive, you know, direction, slamming down on dialogue, silencing people, basically saying, well, the real Catholics, please move over to the side here, and everybody else, you can't come up to communion. I don't know what's going to become of the church, because women represent the most of the people who go to church, the vast majority of the ministers. I mean, if they, and when they leave, their children leave. And I think, you know, women, as Joan Chittister has said many times, the Catholic Church has been bleeding women for decades, and it can't afford to lose them. I mean, I really believe, by the time I finished Good Catholic Girls, that the future of women in the church is the future of the church. If women just completely fell off the map and stopped doing what they're doing, this would be a much smaller, and it would be a truly ailing church.
Mm. Well, early in the book, you note that when women leave the church, so do their children.
Yes. I think we're seeing that now. I mean, you know, there are all these stories about parishes closing and schools closing. And I think part of the schools closing is that women do not want to send their children to a school where they're not going to be accepted as equals, where the religion doesn't accept them as equals. So, I think there are lots of factors in those closings. I don't mean to minimize that you know, populations are changing, and there is the question of, is the church pulling its resources out of poor communities and putting it into more affluent communities? But I think another factor is losing women, is women leaving and their children leaving as well.
The closings thing is very interesting as well, because there are a lot of people who are, you know, standing at the door and saying, you can't close this.
Absolutely. Up in Boston, in fact, I was recently at Voice of the Faithful's national meeting in Indianapolis, and I was sitting at my little table where I was signing books, and a woman came up to me, and she said, oh, no, did I miss Angela Bonavolia? And I said, well, no, actually, I'm Angela Bonavolia. And it turned out she was from the parish up in the Boston area where it was slated to be closed, and they had a vigil, 24-hour vigil in that church for 4 months, refusing to let it close. And in the end, those Catholic people won. They're not gonna close that parish. And their pastor was just deeply devoted to that goal as well. And unfortunately, he suffered terribly in that he was taken out of his position as a pastor and hasn't been reassigned. But the people up there just really took a stand. And there are other parishes in that area where that's happening too. And there are certainly other parts of the country, Detroit, Michigan. There's a lot of work going on there with Catholics who are demanding a say in the closing of schools and parishes.
Mm-hmm. Angela Bonavolia is our guest this afternoon. She's a journalist. She's the author of Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You mentioned a few minutes ago a couple of women who have masters of divinity.
Right.
And in the 1960s, graduate theology programs in the U.S. and Europe began to admit women. This, too, must be affecting the church. How?
This is a really important development. Catholic Theological Society of America, 30% of its members are women. And 50% of its most active members are women. So when they have their annual meeting, half of the people who are doing the work there are women. And it also, well, and one of the stories I tell in the book in terms of how this is affecting things is several years ago when there was a Vatican proclamation that there was to be no more discussion of women's ordination, that it was to be accepted by everybody, and this came from the Pope. He did not declare it, however, an infallible teaching. But then along came Cardinal Ratzinger, who was then the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and he issued a follow-up document basically saying, all but saying that it was infallible teaching. Well, at the time, a woman was the head of the Catholic Theological Society of America, and her name is Elizabeth Johnson, and she is a spectacularly brilliant theologian who teaches up in New York here at Fordham University and who has written wonderful books about the feminine face of God, most important of which is a book called She Who Is. At any rate, Elizabeth Johnson led the society in challenging Cardinal Ratzinger. They basically published a document and took a vote and basically said, you can't do this. This has never been done before. The Pope has to declare something infallible. You, as a part, you know, representing the magisterium, which is all the bishops, you can't really do it because, first of all, she said, Elizabeth Johnson, you haven't polled all the bishops. And if you polled all the bishops, it's very unlikely they would all say, yes, we agree, no ordination of women ever. And you also haven't polled the people. And in Catholic theology, we have something called a sensus fidelium, the sense of the faithful, which is that theology has to also reflect the people's willingness to accept or not accept a particular teaching. So anyway, led by this woman, they basically said, no, we don't accept this as infallible teaching. So that's a struggle right now in the Catholic Church, this attempt to create infallible teachings that are not declared as such by the Pope. In fact, there are only, you know, two infallible teachings in the Catholic Church. The rest are not in that category of teachings.
Mm. Quickly, what are the two?
The two are the Assumption of Mary into Heaven and the Immaculate Conception.
Let's talk with a listener now, a caller waiting for us in Champaign County on line one. Good afternoon.
Curious that both of those are Marianist doctrines, too, isn't it?
Isn't it?
I'm looking from the outside, and I'm sure I'm never going back, but I'm from a very Catholic family, and I'm still preoccupied somewhat with it as But I was very influenced by a book that was published by U of I Press, and Gary Wills reviewed it in the Sun-Times in Chicago, but it's gotten very little, had very little impact, and there are a lot of people that dismiss it out of hand, but it's called The Brief Liberal Catholic Defense of Abortion.
Mm.
And I recommend it because the second half of it actually is directed at people who are really Catholics, but it goes into the history, and to my mind, I'm also curious, interested in it because it gets into the history of ideas and how scientism. The case they make is that the preoccupation with early embryo blastula development was related to 17th century science and the preoccupation with the early days of the microscope, and that it explains why there's been no Catholic ceremony for miscarriage, even though it's now trying to be introduced, I guess. But I think it's quite persuasive and at least should be on the table more often, and I would recommend it to anyone interested in non-Catholics who are interested in the history of ideas, history of science. So I think, yeah, the other point you were making there was that Ratzinger did something that he couldn't do when he wasn't Pope, and now he is. And I've heard a lot of people comment saying, well, there hasn't been a night of long knives, and he hasn't drastically thrown a lot of people out. But I think that the case of America and removing the editor, you know, not even doing it when he was in Rome. They waited until after he had left.
Right.
And gone back to America to announce that he was being replaced. I mean, that's not opening to discourse either. They didn't even explain it particularly
right.
in person.
Right.
So I'm an outside observer, but not completely disinterested. So, but I think that bodes very, very poorly for what will happen next. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you for calling.
You want to make any comment on the
I'm happy to know about that book. I've certainly written a lot about abortion myself and about reproductive health issues and about the church and reproductive health issues. And many of the women in my book, Good Catholic Girls, are dealing with the sexuality issues from birth control, just the need to change the church's teachings on birth control, condoms to prevent the spread of AIDS. Interestingly, I mean, there are women like Frances Kissling, who's the head of an organization called Catholics for Free Choice, which has been fighting for to give Catholics another way to speak about these issues from a Catholic foundation. But it's not only groups like that. I mean, in South Africa, there is a wonderful bishop there, whose name is escaping me at the moment, but it will come back, who took a stand on condoms to prevent the spread of AIDS and saying that, you know, this is not something that prevents the transmission of life, it's something that prevents the transmission of death, and we need to change that policy. And then 60 nuns who call themselves the Sisters for Justice in Johannesburg wrote their own document supporting a change in that issue. So the sexuality issues are very, very important, and certainly gays and lesbians. Sister Janine Gramick, who is in my book, there's a chapter about her work. She fought for the rights of gays and lesbians in the church for 30 years. At a time, she started in the late 60s, early 70s, when there was really no reaching out to Catholic homosexuals. And now today, there are lots of ministries to homosexuals in parishes and dioceses around the country. And this was from the blood, sweat, and tears of Sister Janine, as well as Father Robert Nugent, who worked with her. They were the subject of this, what I call this Kafkaesque investigation by the Vatican over years and years and years. They were publicly censured. They were forbidden from working in the ministry that they began. Then they were forbidden to work at all with gays and lesbians. And finally, they tried to silence both of them, that they couldn't even talk about any of this. And Sister Janine just refused to accept that order. And as a result, she had to leave her religious community of nearly 50 years because she refused that order of silencing. So the sexuality issues are very important. And I think knowing the history and the factors that have influenced the church's positions is really important. So I appreciated the callers addressing that.
Mm. Let us invite others to join us this afternoon. Questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. What are your thoughts? What are the thoughts of those that you know in the church about the underlying reasons or what happened here with this clergy sex abuse scandal?
Oh, dear. I think what happened in terms of just why did...
Let me throw something out here on the table. I wonder if... I'm just thinking out loud here. I haven't really, given it a whole lot of thought. But, is the training of priests, is the attitude, is the view of sexuality, is it not mature in the church?
Well, certainly there are people who have concluded that that's a factor, that that is a part of the problem, that the clergy, that the priesthood has attracted men who were not mature sexually, because certainly, for years they were very young, the men who entered the priesthood, and they really had no experience with sexuality at all. I think, at this point, I the women that I interviewed for Good Catholic Girls really were looking at it more kind of in terms of where we are now, and the work of, for example, Richard Seip, who is a former Benedictine monk and a psychotherapist who has worked with priests for many, many years around these sexuality issues. And his conclusion was that, and this is a startling conclusion, 50% of Catholic priests are sexually active at any one time. Now, a very small portion of them, maybe 6% is what I think he talked, 4 to 6% are involved in sexual molestation of children, which is the most horrible, terrible area that they could be involved in, and we've certainly been focused on that, and there's much still to do there. But many of them are also involved in sexual relationships with adults, both both homosexual and heterosexual relationships. I interviewed a woman who's been sexually involved with a priest for 25 years. They just bought a home together where they're going to retire, and he is a priest in active ministry in a Catholic church in the United States. Not only that, he's helped with vocational counseling for priests in the future. So there's been this, what I call this sort of secret sexuality. The main rule has been, these men have not been allowed to come to a mature, committed, relationship in their lives. The main rule has been, don't let anybody know. And so when you do that, I think in a way you condone a kind of sexual free-for-all, because the rules, there are no real rules there except don't let anybody know, because if people find out about these sexual involvements, well, really, you know, it'll be really bad for the priesthood. So the people, the women that I interviewed for Good Catholic Girls are very great supporters of optional celibacy in the priesthood. And as one priest I interviewed said, the compulsory celibacy is based on a belief that women are inferior by nature and marriage is a second-rate way of being Christian. So, and I think he's right. So that, you know, women support optional celibacy because it's going to change the way women are seen by the church. It's going to bring women and families into the church, and it's going to free priests to have adult, committed, mature, responsible sexual relationships. And, you know, the celibacy teaching, as many Catholics know at this point, didn't really come into being until the 12th century. When Jesus was here and the apostles were here, many of them were married. So this is a relatively, you know, this is not something that goes back to the beginning of time. And we also have, in the Catholic Church, married priests now. If somebody is an Episcopalian, a Lutheran, a Methodist priest, and he is married, and he wants to convert to Catholicism and be a priest, he can come with his family. The only rule that he must follow, and this is kind of a draconian tip of the hat to the misogyny, unfortunately, that we have historically in the church, if his wife dies, he can't marry again. So, that's the only rule. But we already have, you know, married priests in the Catholic Church. So that would change, I think, the sexuality picture in the Catholic Church in terms of the kinds of behavior that we've seen from these priests.
Mm. Another thing that I found striking in your book, at the end of the book, you include a number, you list progressive reform organizations, and there are quite a number of them.
Yes.
I would imagine the progressive reform movement in the church is not monolithic. What do they have in common with one another? How do their views of reform differ from one another?
That's an interesting question. I would say the most dramatic difference right now is between the group that I mentioned before, Voice of the Faithful, which originated in Boston and now has chapters all over the United States, which came out of the sex abuse crisis. It has three clear goals. It has the support of victims of sexual abuse, the support of what they call priests of integrity, and working for structural change in the church. That's the one that makes the church most nervous, but they really define that, Voice of the Faithful, by looking at who's on the parish councils, how did they get there, how can lay Catholics have more autonomy, independence, and power in their churches and their diocese, in their parishes and their dioceses. So that's their focus. They don't go to what they call the hot button issues. Women's ordination, optional celibacy, the sex issues. Now, a group like Voice of the Faithful is at this point the largest of the groups in the United States, claiming something like 35,000 members. Call to Action is second in size, much older than Voice of the Faithful. And Call to Action has a very broad agenda. Call to Action is also dealing with accountability and the sex abuse crisis, but it does also deal with all of the hot button issues. So those would be two examples. And then lots of them are focused on an issue. The Women's Ordination Conference, which is headed by two wonderful young women now. Whenever people say to me, where are the young Catholic women in this movement? I point them to the Women's Ordination Conference. Joy Barnes is the executive director, and she's fantastic. And in fact, what they did, this will just give you a sense of how they work today, during the conclave, the Women's Ordination Conference, in fact, they did this in Chicago, various groups that belong to the Women's Ordination Conference around the country had ceremonies, mostly outside of churches, where they released pink smoke to just make the point that we really need to have women involved in this work. So the Women's Ordination Conference has a focus on women's ordination. And even there, you know, they support different ways of arriving at that goal, including that movement that I mentioned before of women who are just moving ahead and being ordained. And then there are groups like New Ways Ministry, which was founded by Sister Jeanine Gramick, which deals with gays and lesbians, dignity, gays and lesbians, Women Church, which actually that's kind of a collection of small faith communities around the country, including Eucharistic communities, which are, you know, Catholics who come together and have a very kind of liberal, progressive worship style. There's one such group, one of the oldest in the country, called Communitas, which is in Washington, D.C. And they do what's called, they always have a priest and a layperson celebrate the Mass. And when they have a homily, they call it a dialogue homily. So everyone talks. You know, someone reads the gospel, and then they all talk about what that means to them. And it's a very open, kind of interactive model, quite moving. And Women Church is an organization of those kinds of groups around the country that are led by women.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you for a soundbite answer now, because we're out of time.
I'm not so good at that.
We're out of time. You know, going back to your Aunt Anne, and when she said, you know, there are women who like things the way they are. Can you give us some sense of the dialogue of the conversations, discussions you've had with women who are of a more traditionalist bent? Have they been, I mean...
They don't see the church as demeaning women. I would say that would be the biggest difference in terms of our perspectives. They accept that women can't be priests, but women can do other things that are equally valuable and important in the church. And they like the idea of a male priesthood, and they feel that a celibate priest who is really committed to celibacy is extra holy, and they want to hold on to these things. And many such women will not change their minds, and I have to, you know, respect that that's how they feel. But I don't feel that way, and I think that the future of the church really depends on the church acknowledging the other ways that people feel.
There we have to leave it. Angela, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you so much, Celeste.
Angela Bonavolia has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church. The book is published by Regan Books, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. It is 1:53. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Wednesday afternoon, futures in the bean pit moving sharply lower today, down about 19 to 25 cents. We'll take a complete look at those numbers in just a bit. Ideas that a wetter forecast will be coming in the not-too-distant future, but not certainly in the next week or so, have moved that market sharply lower today. And we'll talk to Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, about his take on the trade, along with Drew Lerner, who's the agricultural weather forecaster at World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. That's all coming up during the closing market report this afternoon. Stay with us today for that show. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade down 6 cents today, 333.5, the high, the low at 325.5, and a settlement price there at 326, down 6. December contract down 6 as well, 347.5, the high, the low at 340. Settlement price at 341.5 for the Dease wheat. It was down 6 cents. March contract, 359.5, the high, low at 352.5, and a settlement price, $3.54.5, down a nickel for the day. May futures, 365.5, the high, the low at 360, settled 360.5, down 5 cents. July contract in the wheat pit, 370.5, the high, the low at 363, and the settlement price there at 364.75. They were off 6 cents on the day. September corn futures now, 233.25, the high, the low at $2.25, settlement price at $2.27 a bushel. For the September corn, down 5.5 cents. December, your new crop down 5.5 as well. The settlement price at $2.40 a bushel, with a high at 46.25 and a low at 37.25. March contract in the corn pit, 253.5 the high, the low at 45, settlement price at $2.47.75. They were off 5 cents for the day. May futures, 259 the high, the low at 51.25, and a settlement price at 253, down 5.5 cents. In July contract in the corn pit, 262.5 the high, the low at $2.55, settled 257 a bushel, down 4.75. September for next year, this is the 2006 futures contract, down 3.25, $2.55.25 the settlement price, the low at 55 and the high at 58.5. September oats, 160.5 the high, the low at 158. Settlement on that low, they were down 3 cents for the day. The December contract, a 169 high, low at 166.5. Settlement there at 166.75. They were off 2 cents today. Now the soy complex, heavy losses there in the bean complex. Soybean 694 the high, the low at 670. A lot of technical trade on the way down, 670 down 19.5 cents in a fast market today. September futures, 699.5 the high, the low at 674. Settlement price at $6.75.25, down 19.25. November futures, 709 the high, the low at 608. Settlement price at, low at 680. I scared somebody. And the settlement price at 681.5, down 23. Let me run through those again on the Novembers for you. 709 the high, the low at 680. Settlement price at 681.5, and they were down 23 cents today. January futures, 713 the high, the low at 685. Settlement price at $6.86. They were down 22.5 cents. And the March contract, a 708 high, low at 682. Settlement at 683, down 21.5. May contract in the bean pit, 25 cents lower, $7 the high, the low at 673, and the settlement price for the May soybeans, 2006, 675, down 25 cents. August bean meal, 218 the high, the low at 210.50, settled 210.80. They were down $4.60 for the day. September's were off $5.10 at $209.30. August bean oil, 25.08 the high, the low at 24.30. Settlement price $24.30, down 72 for the day, and the September futures were off 69 at $24.40. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Higher day for cattle, lower day for lean hogs and August bellies. August feeder cattle, 110.17.5, the high 109.50, the low 110.02.5, the settlement, that up 45. September 109.17.5, the high 108.30, the low 108.85, the settlement, that up 55. October 108.40, the high 107.22.5, the low, the settlement 108.35, that up 102.5. August live cattle 82.52.5, the high, the low 81.92.5, the settlement 82.30, that finishing up 57.5. October live cattle 83.80, the high 83.25, the low 83.37.5, the settlement, that up 15. August lean hogs 70.07.5, the high 69.65, the low 69.72.5, the settlement, that down 17.5. October lean hogs 60.80, the high 59.90, the low 60.07.5, the settlement, that down 55. December 58.30, the high 57.70, the low 58.02.5, the settlement, that down 10. February 60.02.5, the high 59.35, the low 59.92.5, the settlement, that down a nickel. August bellies down the limit today 75.35, the high, the low, and settlement 71.90, that down $2. The Dow is off 18 points, the NASDAQ off 6, and the S&P 500 down 2.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer.